Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the number of COVID-19 deaths in the United States surpassed China's reported death toll, according to Johns Hopkins University. The death toll has surpassed 3,400 in the U.S. with over 181,000 confirmed cases. But we still do not know the actual number because testing remains low. And today, we are going to open the lines to take your questions about COVID-19. What do we now know? We'll talk about the importance of testing and the importance of shelter-in-place policies and physical distancing when we are out. Joining us now is Dr. Dina Grayson. Dr. Grayson studied and spent years developing a medical treatment for Ebola. She is closely following the spread of COVID-19 and the latest science. Hi, Dr. Grayson. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Arthur Reingold is Division Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Reingold has worked for over 40 years on the prevention and control of infectious diseases at the national level, including 8 years at the CDC. He's directed the CDC-funded California Emerging Infections Program since 1994, and he's published almost 300 research papers on diseases and influenza. Hi, Professor Reingold. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to help.
Well, I want to ask both of you about the importance of testing, because according to the Washington Post, as of March 28th, exactly 4 weeks after the FDA loosened rules on testing, the United States is still drastically underperforming. Dr. Grayson, can you talk about the importance of testing and where we are today?
Yeah, so, you know, testing is really important and was really important initially in the start of the outbreak here in the United States, because the whole concept here is you identify people early and then you can quarantine them in their contacts. Now that the virus has spread, unfortunately, undetected, was allowed to spread undetected within our communities for months, we're at a point where testing is still extremely valuable, but we also, of course, need lockdowns. And, you know, there's sort of two types of tests that you have to think about. Right now, the only type of test we have looks for the virus itself. So you're looking for people that have an active infection. And that's extremely important as we can monitor where the new outbreaks are happening and also how well our containment and mitigation measures are working, such as lockdowns. But there's another type of test that will be coming soon, which is for the antibody. That looks for people who had the virus, cleared the virus, and are now immune. And that will be really important because it will identify people who, you know, are immune, can't catch the virus, can't spread the virus, and those folks then can go, you know, could go back to work safely. They could also potentially donate their plasma, which has their antibodies that could potentially be used to treat sick patients with COVID-19.
Dr. Grayson, to that point, Dr. Fauci was on CNN a couple of weeks ago, and he said that in order to ensure that you no longer have COVID-19, so let's say you got a positive test, in order to ensure that you're negative, you have to be tested twice on 2 consecutive days. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So that's, you know, these tests are not perfect, right? So they're testing for the virus, and you have to stick a nasal swab up the nose into the deep part of the recesses of what we call the nasopharynx, which is way in the back of your nasal passages. And sometimes those tests, you know, you just don't get a bit of a sample that has the virus on it. You know, this virus really also likes the lower respiratory tract. We're not sampling down deep in the lungs. And so the idea here is that we want to make sure that, you know, sometimes people can harbor this virus for several weeks. We want to make sure that we're not saying to people, hey, you're negative, and they actually have the virus, and then they're out circulating around the community and spreading this highly contagious virus. So the idea here is by doing 2 tests in a row that you have a lot more confidence and ability to really determine that somebody truly is negative and is no longer what we call shedding virus and able to spread it.
Professor Reingold, what would you say about the importance of testing and where we are today?
Well, I certainly agree that we're basically talking about two types of tests. They're going to be used for very different purposes. And we don't have the antibody blood test yet, but other countries are moving ahead rapidly with that. And I would expect that will allow us to help figure out who has been exposed, who might be immune, who can safely go back to work. I think with regard to testing for the virus itself, it's certainly true we need to substantially expand that capability, and we've been quite late doing that. I think a lot of the usage of that testing at this point is going to help in the healthcare setting as healthcare providers try to figure out who has COVID-19 and who doesn't to try and avoid using personal protective equipment if it isn't necessary. I think it's going to be helpful in terms of making decisions about isolation of individuals. And certainly it will be helpful in doing epidemiologic studies of the virus in the population. But it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody should run out and get him or herself tested for this virus. And I just want to point out one clarification, which is the idea of getting tested twice. That's absolutely important if you're trying to document that someone who had the infection has cleared it and no longer has it. But it doesn't really deal with the question of I might not have the virus today, but next week I could get the virus. And so, it certainly doesn't deal with what the future holds in store with regard to someone's continuing exposure.
Well, I'm wondering, for people who are sick and, you know, maybe they don't have access to the test or they're not going to get tested, and they have all of these symptoms, and then in 2 weeks they feel better. Can you just talk about that, Professor Reingold? Because I've been seeing that a lot on social media.
Well, so first of all, for people who were sick, ideally it would we want them first to talk to their healthcare provider by phone and get feedback about what they should do. We certainly want them to avoid situations where they can infect other people through social distancing, wearing a mask, staying at home, things like that. Whether that requires knowing your test status, I think ideally it does, but if we don't have enough tests, then we can still implement those measures even without knowing whether your test is positive or not. If the question is, however, at what point can you go back into the community and stop doing some things, then clearly, as was suggested, having a couple of negative tests in a row would certainly be reassuring. But at the moment, we're not in a position, I don't think, to offer testing to as many people as who might need it.
And I'm not sure where that sound is coming from, but would you mind muting your computer so we don't get those sounds? That would be great. Thank you. Dr. Grayson, go ahead.
Yeah, so a couple of things. So first of all, with respect to testing, I think we need to remind everyone what this administration has promised the American people. Look, I called for testing in January. I and other experts, we called for this in January. We had a golden opportunity very early on to implement testing. So South Korea and the United States, we each had our first case on the exact same day, okay? So bear that in mind. South Korea had their first test approved in 1 week, and they rolled out drive-through testing. I mean, you can't walk down the street without seeing a testing center. You know, it's easier than getting a coffee, okay? And they've contained what was a very large outbreak in that started in this church group. Now, we had every opportunity in this country, and instead we had Mr. Trump denying that there was an issue, saying, nothing to see here, totally bungling the rollout of testing. And then finally, once there was a realization of, okay, yeah, Houston, we have a problem here, on March 10th, Mr. Pence promised 4 million more tests by March 13th. Then on March 13th, Trump himself promised an additional 1.4 million tests by March 16th. Okay, so that's more than 5 million tests by mid-March. Then doubling down on these lies, March 21st, another White House official claimed there would be 27 million tests by the end of March. Well, here are the facts. okay, the facts, because I deal in facts. I'm a physician scientist here. Only 1 million tests, only 1 million tests have been performed in the entire month of March for a country of 330 million people. And that includes the people that are getting multiple tests. So we haven't tested anywhere close to the number of people we want. And if we want to reopen our country, we have got to have tests. I mean, our first responders, we're seeing a ton of people testing positive in New York City. Now, in Florida, we are barely testing. California is barely testing. You know, I know of many, many, many cases because people call me where they have been, you know, people have been told, yeah, you've got COVID by every symptom, you know. The wife has anosmia, lack of taste, lack of smell, lack of taste, anosmia, agusia, and then the husband gets really sick, classic signs, but there are no tests. By the way, those people are not being counted in our official statistics as well. So we are massively undercounting, we're massively undertesting. And this is just the first wave of infections. I mean, there's going to be a second wave coming, and we better have our act together. Because if we don't, I mean, we've got people going into nursing homes. I mean, and I live in Florida where we have a lot of older folks, you know, and we're not testing them. And we know there's asymptomatic spread, and 40% of infections occur in young people that many of whom have, you know, no symptoms or mild symptoms. They don't even know they're carrying the virus. And they're super spreaders. They're, you know, your bartenders, your baristas, your waiters, your food delivery people nowadays, and, you know, folks working in hospitals, first responders. So we've got to solve this problem, because if we don't, this second wave of infections that comes is, you know, it's going to be so much worse than this first wave. And we're already talking about potentially losing 80 plus thousand American lives just in this first wave of infections.
Dr. Grayson, I'll ask you to elaborate on a few things you brought up, but let's just stick with testing for right now. Professor Reingold, the Los Angeles Times has had a number of stories about why California is so behind a state like New York when it comes to testing. They have also pointed out that the programs have just happened in an uncoordinated fashion. So you might have state labs, you have hospitals, and you have private outfits. And right now they're just not talking to each other, but that is the ultimate goal. So I also want to ask you, what can we expect in places like Georgia, Michigan, Oklahoma, for example? Because Politico just had a piece called "The Next Coronavirus Hotspots Are in States That Are Not Testing Enough." And the numbers in these places are very, very low. So, for example, New York is testing about 950 for every 100,000 people. Oklahoma is only testing 43 for 100,000 people. So what are your thoughts on what we can expect from states like Oklahoma and Michigan, for example?
So I guess I have a couple of comments. First of all, there's no question if we're only counting laboratory confirmed cases, we will do a bad job of counting and documenting the extent of the problem if we're not testing people adequately and if testing is not available. So clearly that contributes to a poor understanding of where the virus is and how quickly it's spreading. You know, I think the other contextual issue, as I think everyone knows, is that after the rather lengthy delay in making large numbers of tests available, at this point, certainly a number of companies, a number of commercial laboratories, a number of university laboratories have and are scaling up. And so a state like Oklahoma, a state like Florida, wherever, certainly will have much better access to testing in the weeks to come than we did, you know, a month ago. So there should be much more availability of testing, but how even that will be, how it will be applied, I think there probably is going to be a lot of unevenness for the foreseeable future.
Dr. Grayson, a listener just sent us the CDC page on testing, and it looks like the number of analyzed tests are about 153,000, according to the CDC page. Where can we go for government data at the federal level to find out how many tests have been done and what the results are?
There are, as far as I'm aware, there is no warehouse of data that compiles all this. So the CDC website will include the total number of tests that are being conducted at the CDC and public health laboratories. But they don't include the vast majority of testing, of course, which is being conducted at your private diagnostic companies. And, you know, these are the companies that really have the bandwidth. They have these what we call high throughput testing, which are done by machines. So they're able to analyze tens and tens of thousands of samples, supposedly, in a day. But clearly that's not happening. And, you know, another thing that we also need to make sure that we're aware of here is not just where the tests are being conducted, but also where are we seeing these outbreaks and the types of patients and risk factors. It is extremely disturbing to me as a physician when we're starting to see these outbreaks in places like Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, New Orleans, where the Deep South, Mississippi, Missouri. No one's talking about Missouri. Missouri had the highest increase, 600% increase in 1 week of any place in the world. No one's talking about that. And a lot of the patients that live in these areas are lower income. We have a lot of folks that are, minorities that have higher risk factors, number of risk factors, including heart disease. So they're much, much, much more likely to have serious disease and even death, and also higher percentage of uninsured patients. And no one's talking about that. And it's really disturbing to me because these are the folks who are most vulnerable that are really going to suffer from this.
Right. And in fact, The Guardian spoke with Dr. Tina Chopra, professor of infectious diseases at Wayne State, and she said she's very concerned that cities with high rates of poverty and a lack of fresh water, we're talking about clean water just coming out of your sink, they are at a risk of a very high rate of infection. She pointed out that one-third of people in Detroit live in poverty. Professor Reingold, what are your concerns about the spread in places that have high levels of poverty?
As is already noted by Dr. Grayson, in our country, people who are poor have a much higher prevalence of the conditions like heart disease and lung disease that predispose to a more severe case of COVID-19 if you get infected. So that's certainly of concern. Number one. Number two, they have a poor access to health care, both as the outpatient and the inpatient level. So that certainly is of concern in terms of their access to care when they do get sick. But obviously, in addition, people living in poverty tend to live often in more crowded neighborhoods, as was already alluded to. It may have less access to easy hand washing and other types of facilities. So it's certainly quite possible that we will see higher rates of transmission and more difficulty following recommendations about social distancing in poor communities compared to wealthy communities.
The New York Times has a piece called Coronavirus Sweeps Through Detroit, a city that has seen crisis before, and they report that in less than 2 weeks, 35 people have died in Detroit. The police chief has tested positive. More than 500 police officers are in quarantine. Dr. Grayson, the other thing, we're going to do a show about this, you know, what about rural hospitals? If we don't have the proper PPE in a place like New York City, and in places like San Francisco, they're gearing up for potentially running out of PPE, the protective equipment. What about rural hospitals? Are you hearing from rural docs and nurses?
Absolutely. And it's not just the PPE that's lacking. We're also lacking ventilators. We don't have large ICU units. I mean, a lot of folks in more rural communities, there's a higher percentage of folks that are on Medicaid, for example, that don't have insurance. And the hospitals are not equipped with these large, gleaming ICUs, and they don't have the capacity to just suddenly build a huge surge capacity because they're low on doctors. And, you know, the blunt and brutal reality is that if you are sick with COVID-19 and you need a ventilator and you don't get one, you die. Okay, that's the facts. And we don't have ventilators. Again, another failure of this administration, you know, with a deadly, highly contagious virus like this, you get behind, people die. And that's what's happened here. You know, now, of course, Mr. Trump said, okay, we're going to invoke the Defense Production Act. We're going to ramp up and produce magically somehow, right, we're going to have 100,000 ventilators in 100 days. Like, who really believes that? I don't. I'll believe it when I see it, maybe by October. But in the meantime, we're woefully short. And where are the masks? Where are the gowns? Where are the gloves? Where are they? We haven't ramped up production of those. What's taking so long? Why hasn't the Defense Production Act been invoked for that? I don't get it. I don't get it. My friends are on the front lines. And they are being told all across this country, whether rural hospitals. I have friends in the Bay Area in California who are telling me, who are practicing physicians, Dina, you know, and they're telling me this privately because they're afraid to speak up because doctors get fired for speaking up. They're like, Dina, I'm not allowed to wear a mask. They're not allowed to wear a mask to see patients because there either aren't enough masks or they're being told, oh, you'll scare the patient. We know that there's asymptomatic transmission. I've been told this by doctors who are cancer doctors. They're not allowed to wear masks to see their cancer patients. That is just crazy. I mean, again, asymptomatic spread. I mean, and some of these folks are practicing at the very world-famous cancer centers, and they're not allowed to wear a mask when they go in the patient's room to see their patients. I mean, there's a problem here, and the big part of it is where's the PPE, the personal protective equipment? Why haven't we ramped it up? Our needs are not going to go down. I mean, you know, New York City is kind of the canary in the coal mine. Everyone's like, well, but 50% of the cases are in New York. Oh, yeah. And 50% of the cases are not. And we're seeing cases skyrocket. Here in Florida, we have not locked down. We still haven't locked down. We're barely testing. And these cases are exploding. So, you know, we don't have enough ventilators. We don't have enough personal protective equipment. Our doctors and nurses are getting sick, dying. And if they die or are sick, who's going to take care of us? And then if you're sick and there are no ventilators, what happens? I mean, this is a total, total, total fail. And we're failing with the test. I mean, this first wave is going to be much smaller than the second wave, okay? And we're failing this first little test. And I fear for what's going to happen next flu season because, you know, my fear is that we're going to see this first wave of infections. Mr. Trump's going to say, hey, yay, look, all of our efforts worked. We did such a great job. And then he's not going to prepare for this much bigger second wave that's going to last the full flu season. And I remind your listeners that during the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, 80% of the people who died, of the Americans who died, they died during the second wave. The first wave hit in March, just like now. Second wave came in the fall, and we had that full flu season for that virus to just spread like wildfire. And if we're not prepared for the second wave, it's going to be way, way, way worse than 80 to 100,000 dead.
Dr. Dina Grayson studied and spent years developing a medical treatment for Ebola. She is closely following the spread and the latest science. And after a break, we will talk about the next wave that people are discussing, and that's supposed to happen in the fall. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the importance of shelter-in-place policies and what is happening in the states that do not have one. Dr. Grayson also did mention that some hospitals are telling doctors that they will be fired if they speak out about a lack of PPE. And if you want to read more about that, Bloomberg had a story about that just yesterday. We're also joined today by Arthur Reingold, Division Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Reingold has worked for over 40 years on the prevention and control of infectious diseases. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about community organizations and community groups doing outreach to help the most vulnerable. We're talking about community groups trying to reach older people living alone, people with disabilities, or people who are just isolated. And if you have any questions or any resources you'd like us to share, please email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you have any questions about COVID-19, about testing, shelter in place, what we now know, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Dr. Dina Grayson. Dr. Grayson has studied and spent years developing a medical treatment for Ebola. She's closely following the spread and the latest science around COVID-19. Professor Arthur Reingold is Division Head of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Reingold, a number of people are talking about the next wave. and that is supposed to happen in the fall. What do we need to do? Well, first off, can you tell us what we should expect? I mean, obviously, Dr. Fauci has been talking about this. What are your thoughts about this next wave?
So you've already heard Dr. Grayson talking about the pandemic of 1918 of influenza, where certainly the first wave was in the spring, and then the much worse wave was the following winter. And many people think it is reasonable to extrapolate from influenza virus to this coronavirus. I'm a little more taking a wait-and-see attitude. I think it's certainly highly likely that we will see a second wave in the fall and in the winter. But these are different viruses, and I think we need to acknowledge that we don't know everything there is to know about this particular coronavirus. But we certainly need to act as though and be prepared for a second wave in the fall. We don't know whether that we'll see a diminution in cases during the summer, as typically happens with influenza. But certainly, even if we do, and whether that's from our efforts at sheltering in place and social distancing and or climate factors, we certainly need to be much better prepared for continuing transmission and another wave when fall and winter come in 6 months.
Dr. Grayson, what do we need to do now to prepare for a possible wave?
Several things. First of all, we actually really need to ramp up testing, not talk about it, but be transparent. And we need a central warehouse of all the data of who's tested and what were those test results. I think we also need to leverage other technologies such as Kinza, these smart thermometers that may provide some data on early detection of fevers before people call their doctor. There seems to be reasonable evidence that looking where new fevers are happening across the country is a very, very early warning sign. And we need to ramp up supplies, PPE, personal protective equipment, and ventilators. And we need to get field hospitals ready to go. I mean, we need to prepare. I mean, when you're dealing with a pandemic, you have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best, not the opposite. Okay, if we wait until the second wave happens and we get behind as we did this first time, people will die. I mean, that's the reality. Inaction, you know, lack of action in the face of a rapidly spreading deadly virus. If you don't act quickly, people die. So this is something that needs to happen now. And I really truly hope that we do catch a little bit of a break over the summer where we don't have this sustained substantial community spread of the virus so that we can literally and figuratively catch our breath. But we need to do it. And we have to plan. And then lastly, we need to also make sure we have these antibody tests in place. We need to identify folks that are immune because I think those folks are going to be really, really critical because they can be working in quote unquote hazardous, areas that have high exposure to virus and have, pretty low risk, if not none. One other thing I would add is that we need to start doing some other things at risk, like manufacturing antiviral drugs. There are several investigational antiviral medicines that are being tested that may work against this coronavirus. And we should go ahead and start ramping up production of many, many doses of these drugs at risk. And the reason I say that is if we're able then with a very aggressive testing program and we happen to identify an early cluster of infections, not only do you want to isolate people and their contacts, if there are medicines that we can treat these people with and their contacts, antivirals, you decrease the viral shedding, the amount of time and the amount of virus. And that decreases the ability of them to infect other people. These are also important tools and weapons in our battle against this virus. But we have to get going yesterday. We can't wait.
Dr. Grayson, Professor Rangel, go ahead.
Well, also just to say, I don't disagree with any of that, but the other thing that we have been confronted by in our response and it needs to be addressed in the coming weeks and months is improvements and augmentations to our public health infrastructure. People at the county and state level who have to do the responding, we need more of them. We need them quickly. Someone needs to pay for them, and they need better technology and ability to use modern technological approaches to data gathering and data interpretation. And those will be two very important things that we need to address before any next wave.
Dr. Grayson, you mentioned the drive-through testing in Korea. I've also seen videos of what look like phone booths where people just walk in a box and they get tested right away and then it's cleaned immediately. We have a question from Bibi. Why is the United States not using the fast and easy testing methodology of Korea?
Well, that's an outstanding question, and I think you have to go right to the White House. Remember that Mr. Trump weeks ago promised that we'd have all of these drive-through testing sites, right? And he was that you could drive to your local big box store, big box pharmacy, and have drive-through testing. That was weeks ago. So we have thousands of these. As of last week, we had a total of 5 in the country, of close to 30,000 of these large box retail pharmacies. 5. Okay, we haven't done it. Now we need to also and agree with you about the phone booth type testing. These work really well in urban areas where, you know, in New York City, many people don't have a car. They're not cruising around in a car. They're walking or taking rideshare or the subway, right? So you need to have walkthrough testing. And these are brilliant. You have to make testing really, really, really accessible. It has to be free and it has to be fast. If you don't have all three of those things, it won't work. We don't want people standing around being close to one another for hours waiting for their test results because they could spread the virus, right? And if it's not free, if it's not readily accessible, people aren't going to do it. And if we want to reopen our society, like South Korea has been able to do quite well, we need to do this. And you've got to, and the other thing is we've got to have, you know, citizens of this country have to stand up and participate. We can't have these, like these 20-year-olds that from University of Texas that just chartered a jet and went down to Mexico to party during, you know, in March, and they came back and a third of them, of these 70 kids, are all infected with coronavirus. I mean, no more of that. You know, I mean, this is we have a public health threat that threatens everyone, and the least healthy person amongst us puts everyone at risk. I mean, everyone. And so this is an all hands on deck thing. We've never experienced anything like this ever in our country. Never. I mean, people in Western Europe get it. They, you know, folks that are older that lived through World War II, they understand what it's like to see their loved ones around them dying. But people in this country, I mean, we haven't experienced something like this, and people need to wake up. This is things have changed, fundamentally changed for us, and they're going to change, and it's going to be like this, not for the next couple weeks, not for the next couple months. We're looking at least a year of this, at least.
Can you elaborate? What do you mean by that, at least a year?
Well, it's very unlikely that this virus is going to go away and we're going to be in the all clear zone in a couple months. It's just very, very, very unlikely. You know, the reality is, in order to have what we call herd immunity, meaning enough people within the total population who have immunity so that essentially you're blocking the spread so it can't spread like wildfire, this virus, you need to reach around 70 to 80% of people that are immune. And there's only really two ways you can become immune. The first is you get infected, you survive, you clear the virus, and now you're immune. The second is a vaccine. And, you know, I would love to tell everyone listening, hey, don't worry, we're going to have a vaccine by October. That will not happen. The very, 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 very best case scenario is that we might have some doses of vaccine, maybe, that are experimental, that we might have enough to vaccinate some of our workers, like healthcare workers in high risk situations. But we're looking at a minimum. I mean, it would break every record in the book if we had a vaccine available a year from now. And a year from now means we have to live through that next, very likely, very large, much more deadly second wave of infections. So we're not going to get there. So the only thing we have at our disposal is testing, testing, and retesting, including healthy people, including antibody testing, contract tracing, very aggressive contact tracing. And as the professor just mentioned, that means bolstering our public health efforts to track down contacts, make sure people are isolated, and then quarantines. And if we want to avoid these massive lockdowns, and we've got, what, 250 million people right now in our country at least that are basically locked down. our economy is shut down. People can't go to work, many people. This is devastating. If we really want to open things back up, there's not going to be this magical silver bullet of, you know, it's not like the movies where, and again, I worked during the Ebola crisis to develop a cure. And, you know, we really felt like we had something to help patients. But it's not like, hey, we discovered it and then suddenly, you know, the scene switches and now everyone's gotten treatment and everyone's fine. No, it takes many, many, many months. Even if we knew we had a vaccine today that worked, that means you've got to manufacture 300 million doses. That does not happen easily. It does not happen overnight. And we don't have a vaccine today. So that means the chances of us having one by October are basically zero.
Professor Reingold, what would you add to that? Do you agree with Dr. Grayson's assessment?
Well, we're certainly not going to have a coronavirus vaccine for this fall. I think that's clearly the case. Dr. Fauci himself has said it's 12 to 18 months away and that would be a remarkable, unprecedented feat. We certainly are not going to start giving large numbers of people a coronavirus vaccine that hasn't been shown to be safe and we hope effective. So that's just not going to happen before this winter. And we can say that with a certainty, frankly. So we're going to have to do the best we can this coming fall and winter without a vaccine and with the tools we've already been talking about.
Professor Reingold, what message would you send to people who are uninsured or underinsured? Because we're getting a lot of stories about high bills, even though testing is supposed to be free. We did a show about this earlier in the week. If you go to an out-of-network provider, you might receive a surprise bill. And, you know, if you are sick, as Dr. Grayson has said, there's a possibility that you might spend many, many days in the hospital. And, you know, people are already strapped trying to make ends meet. To add hospital bills to that is very daunting. So what message would you send to people who are concerned about costs?
Well, of course, in our country, since we don't have universal health care like other wealthy countries, people are right to be concerned about that. I wish I had a simple answer or solution to that problem. But, you know, I think the most important message is people who are sick and with this virus or otherwise and need care should go and get care. And if bills start coming in, the hope is that there will be some way in which some of these federal relief packages can help them address those needs. But they certainly should seek care if they are ill, because there's really not much you can do a couple months later if you didn't seek care when you were quite ill and needed that care.
Well, on this topic, let's take a caller, and then Dr. Grayson will get you to respond. Let's go to John in Alameda. Hi, John. John wanted to know what you think of Medicare for All, Dr. Grayson, and if you can also just respond to the question I asked Professor Reingold.
Well, I mean, we certainly need health care for everyone, and I am a firm believer in having universal health care coverage. I think that the political realities are that, you know, if politics 101 is that if you try to take something away from people, that's politically unpopular. So I am a huge proponent of expanding Medicare to everyone who does not have insurance, who wants insurance, who wants Medicare, they should have it. And if other folks want their own private insurance, just like in the UK, just like other countries that have universal health care, if people want to buy their own insurance and throw away their money, like, who am I to tell them not to do it? But I am a firm believer in a massive, huge expansion of Medicare. To everyone who needs it and wants it, they should get it.
All right. Well, thank you for that question. I want to ask you both about the importance of shelter-in-place policies. Dr. Grayson, you mentioned this earlier. The Chronicle is reporting that as of Monday, we still have six states with no mandatory shelter-in-place directives at the city or state level. That they are Nevada, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Arkansas. Can you talk about this?
Well, sure. And actually, add Florida to that list. We do not have a statewide shelter-in-place order. Okay, and we are the third most populous state, and we have one of the oldest populations in the state. It's criminal. I mean, everyone saw the pictures of those spring breakers here in Florida. not only potentially bringing virus, spreading it amongst themselves, but then they jumped in their cars or planes and went back to God knows where, potentially taking the virus with them. I think that it is dangerous and reckless of these state officials not to lock down. Because, look, the reality with this virus is the way it tends to spread through communities is that it tends to spread through younger folks, okay? So that at least 40% of infections, and we've seen this in multiple countries, including here, that about 40% of the infections are in younger people, ages 20 to 39, 40 years old. And a lot of those folks have very mild symptoms, no symptoms. You know, they're not getting hospitalized. And they're, again, out and about in the community, spreading the virus. We call them super spreaders. So when you start seeing people get hospitalized and getting really, really sick, that's really more of a lagging indicator. And Dr. Birx has actually echoed this from the podium at the White House briefings. She said this. She's like, when you start seeing people get in the hospital, you know, it's really too late. That means that viruses aren't even spreading and spreading and spreading because, you know, older folks don't tend to go out as much, right? Even though they're at higher risk, if they do catch the virus of getting seriously ill or even dying, they're not out and about and exposed as much. It's our younger people that are really the ones, a much higher percentage of them that are being infected. So these communities that are open are putting their own citizens at risk. So I think that, I don't want to say the word criminal, I think that, you know, but to me, as a physician, it's utterly appalling, and it is endangering people's lives. No one wants to lock down. No one wants to live in a lockdown community. But unfortunately, because of the complete missteps and bungling by the federal government, by the Trump administration, that's the only option we have right now, because we don't have effective treatments. We don't have a vaccine. So right now, what we need is people to stay home so we're not spreading the virus, and we hope that let's get this first wave of infections through and then hopefully implement extremely aggressive testing measures, as we discussed earlier in the program, so that we have an opportunity to reopen our society. But if and until we do that, I mean, the more you're out and about, this virus spreads exponentially. That means more people are infected, the hospitals get overwhelmed, and if you don't have enough ventilators and you need a ventilator, you die. So we've got to flatten that curve. If we don't, people die.
Professor Reingold, it's also important to note, the New York Times had a piece yesterday reporting that as many as 25% of people infected with COVID-19 may not show symptoms. And this is according to the director of the CDC.
Well, so, you know, this has been an area of immense uncertainty and importance. What proportion of these infections are totally asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, and certainly knowledge is increasing and pointing in the direction, which is not too surprising, that many people who acquire this infection will be asymptomatic or will have a very brief illness and then get better. I think from a public health point of view, the real question is to what extent are these people transmitting their infection to others, to their grandparents, to frail elderly, to other people? How much of the transmission in the community is attributable to people who are asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, that is to say infected but haven't yet developed symptoms? And I would say that there is increasing evidence that such asymptomatic infections are an important part of transmission. And to the extent that that's true, it makes our prevention control all the more difficult.
Dr. Grayson, we're just getting some breaking news here that Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida, I'm reading from the Orlando Sentinel, has finally relented and is ordering Floridians to stay at home beginning at midnight tomorrow night.
Well, about darn time, okay? About darn time. And when you had even, you know, Mr. Trump's former FDA commissioner, who's, you know, on the red team, I'm on the blue team, but when it comes to life and death, I don't care what team you're on, I'm on the life team, okay? And he was getting hammered by people in his own party. It's ludicrous that he waited this long. It's utterly ludicrous. So good, finally, that Governor DeSantis did this, but too little, too late. And, you know, I the number of people that Mr. DeSantis has put at risk who are potentially going to get infected and potentially die, that's on him, and it's unconscionable.
Wow. Well, again, Florida is just announcing that there will be a stay-at-home order beginning tomorrow at midnight, tomorrow night. Professor Reingold, can you talk about the importance of shelter in place? You know, so many of us in the Bay Area, because we were the first ones in the country to embrace the shelter in place policy. Do we know what effect that is having at this point?
Well, I think the honest answer is it's still a tad early to know, and we'll certainly have a much better answer to that question in another week or two. But I think there is growing suspicion and some evidence that the earlier an area or county or state does this, A, the more likely it is to have a positive effect, and B, that there is at least some initial evidence that may in fact be true. Here are the measures we're looking at, because we don't know about transmission of the virus in the community directly. We're primarily looking at hospitalizations and deaths on the assumption that they represent a relatively constant fraction of all of the infections that are occurring, but they tend to follow by 2 to 3 weeks when the infections occur. So I would expect that in another week or two, we're going to have a much better answer to that, but I'm cautiously optimistic that we are going to validate the assumption that earlier and more effective social distancing does in fact reduce COVID-19 illnesses and deaths.
Dr. Grayson, go ahead. Dr. Grayson?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that it's pretty clear that these lockdowns work. I think the evidence shows this, and we start to see a decline in the rate of rise of infections. It does take time because of the incubation period, of course. We know that this virus can have an incubation period of up to 14 days. And then it usually takes, on average, up to, you know, somewhere between 3 to 8 days before someone actually starts feeling sick, before they actually go to the hospital and then potentially go to the ICU. And so when we look at hospitalizations, when we look at ICU admissions, and when we look at deaths, those are lagging indicators. It takes time, okay? So that's why when you see that first case, when you start seeing the first cases, you have to lock down or else people die.
We have two more questions for both of you, and we're almost out of time. Bloomberg reported on a new study out of Italy from their health authority. They found that more than 99% of Italy's coronavirus fatalities were people who suffered from previous medical conditions. Dr. Grayson, have you seen this, and what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I have, and that's been pretty consistent with data we've seen from other countries as well. I mean, Italy has one of the oldest populations on the planet. And of course, when folks get older, they tend to have, you know, higher number of comorbid conditions like heart disease, chronic lung disease, including asthma, emphysema, as well as diabetes. So all of these types of conditions, you know, essentially this virus is tough and it's a nasty, nasty bug. And so if your lungs aren't functioning properly, if your heart isn't functioning properly, if you have underlying diabetes, that puts you at higher risk for serious illness and death. And that's been pretty consistent around the world.
And Professor Reingold, what really strikes you about the data that you've been hearing about patients in the United States?
Well, I think it's certainly the case, as was already alluded to, that the people most at risk of getting very, very sick and dying are the frail elderly and people with these various types of underlying conditions. I do think that's important to keep in mind when making comparisons of death rates or hospitalization rates from one area to another. And just to go to Florida for a minute, Florida, as I understand it, has a fairly large elderly population, people retired or who spend the winters there, for example. And so, you need to look at what the age distribution of the cases is and what illnesses they have when you compare the case fatality in one group versus another, because to the extent that the people getting sick are mostly older people with underlying conditions, we would expect, unfortunately, the fatality rates to be higher.
Right. And Dr. Grayson, this is also affecting younger people. What do we know about that population, just briefly?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that for whatever reason, younger, you know, there's this misperception that if you're younger, like, it's no big deal. Look, you know, for younger folks, yes, your risk is lower, but it's not zero, okay? And we also know that younger people, as I mentioned earlier in the show, are actually much more likely to be infected because they're the ones out and about and not practicing social distancing measures. So that your chances of being infected are actually higher. So we are seeing around this country way too many younger people that are in the hospital, that are in the ICUs, and that are unfortunately potentially could die. So I think that everyone needs to understand that this virus, while the vast majority of people, 80% of people, have a relatively, I say relatively, mild infection, meaning it's, you know, having a really nasty flu is no fun and hardly, you know, nothing to sort of, not think about, take seriously. Even though the vast majority will have sort of this, you know, self-limited infection, 20% of people won't. And 5% of people on average are in the ICU. And, you know, once you're in the ICU, your chance of dying is about 50%.
And
so
just briefly,
need to take this seriously.
Briefly, Dr. Grayson, we only have seconds left. Should people start wearing DIY do-it-yourself masks?
Well, these DIY do-it-yourself masks are valuable to protect, partially valuable to protect other people from you. So it keeps you from or decreases the amount of germs that you're spraying into the community, if you will. But they're not going to really protect you from breathing them in. So it's one of these things where, you know, I wish we had ramped up production of masks because then everyone could wear masks like they do in Asia. And I think that would have been very valuable. But unfortunately, we're in a situation where we don't even have enough masks for people who really need them, which are our healthcare providers. So, you know, DIY masks, while, you know, it's better than nothing, that's kind of where we're at.
Dr. Dena Grayson and Professor Arthur Reingold, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.